ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The summer is coming to an end in the Northern Hemisphere, and in the Southern Hemisphere, I guess our winter's coming to an end, but I've got a cold, my first of the season. I thought I'd dodged it, but too much socialising at the Melbourne International Film Festival last week. It has been a massively successful summer for the studios in America. They've made more than $4 billion at the US box office. Five films have broken the $1 billion mark in worldwide box office. The two biggest, of course, are the new Spider-Man movie and The Odyssey. But in America, it's been one of the top five biggest summer movie seasons of all time, the biggest since 2019. And so it does feel like 2026 is the year that maybe we can finally say that audiences have come back to the movies after COVID. And the year looks like it's going to truck on nicely because there's a really big Marvel film coming out in December. There's a Tom Cruise movie. There are quite a few movies that are coming out that look like they will attract audiences. They're very commercially appealing offerings, I would say. Hello, Jason DeRosso here. That's my name. This is The Screen Show, broadcasting and podcasting to you, of course, via ABC Radio National. Oh, the voice is a little bit croaky. I do apologise once again. Going back to this conversation about how big the summer's been, well, the summer is not yet over, and making his late run in the final stretch of this mid-year holiday season is a man who is no stranger to populist entertainment. He is 88 years young. I'm talking about Ridley Scott. He is back with a new film about the end of the world, and he is coming up in a moment, as is Josh Brolin, who also stars in this new movie. It's called The Dog Stars. It's based on Peter Heller's novel, adapted by Revenant screenwriter Mark L. Smith. It's set in the aftermath of a viral apocalypse, and it's a film about finding community, about falling in love. It also stars Jacob Elordi, Margaret Qualley, Guy Pearce, and Alison Janney. But whatever you do, don't call it a zombie movie. The day the whole world
went away. Before the world ended, I was kissing my wife, playing with my dog.
Jasper!
The world that was doesn't exist. Here it's just us trying to hold on to what was.
But out there,
it's kill or be killed. The only thing left to fear
survivors.
Of course, Ridley Scott is no stranger to imagining the end of it all. He's made films before about characters fumbling around in the ruins of a civilization or in the blood-splattered hull of a spaceship. For me, his late career triumph so far, however, has been that gothic noir, The Counselor, which he made off a script by Cormac McCarthy. I Will Die on This Hill. It was a genuinely strange, stylistically extravagant film, unafraid to push the boundaries, even slightly into bad taste, and I recommend you seek it out if you were put off by some of the bad reviews of The Counselor at the time. Anyway, The Dog Stars is not that kind of picture. It's actually quite a gently lyrical film about a young man, played by Jacob Elordi, who decides that even in a world that's as dangerous as this one, he wants to travel beyond the horizon to see what's there. It's set in a mountainous landscape, shot in Italy, but supposed to be near Denver, and the world is overrun by these vicious hordes. Now, I wasn't sure exactly who they were, and I thought if I wasn't sure watching it and paying attention, I did want to relay to you that slight confusion that I had, because I think the film's a bit unclear. They're not zombies, but they are this kind of rabid and violent and sort of tribal mass of people who are kind of roaming the countryside. Anyway, Elordi and Josh Brolin's character are a pair of dudes who live on an old airfield and have kind of staked out their space there. Brolin is this hardened ex-soldier who shoots anything that moves beyond the perimeter. And he just wants to be safe. While Elordi is a pilot, he flies his Cessna every day to scout for incoming dangers and occasionally fly into town, into an absolutely ransacked Denver, and pick up or scavenge for some supplies. One day while flying, he hears a faint radio signal from a place called the Grand Junction, and he decides he wants to check it out, much to his older companion's consternation. Now, it's a film with a lot of beautiful shots of the little Cessna flying amongst alpine valleys. There are quite a few violent gunfights in the film, and central to the movie are a pair of characters, a father and daughter, played by Guy Pearce and Margaret Qualley, who end up coming along for this ride. Inevitably, The Dog Stars is a film that speaks to anxieties about borders. It speaks to how people start to fight over dwindling resources. And it also is a film that interrogates the dark side of a certain American frontier ideal. When eventually we discover who's behind the faint radio signal from Grand Junction, the film offers a modest, not unpredictable revelation about selfishness and the survivalist impulse. I won't spoil it for you, but I will say that there is a gentle romance at the heart of this film that works quite well, and a bromance that arguably works even better between Elordi and Brolin. For now, director Ridley Scott is coming up. I interviewed him last Friday night. And a warning, there's strong language ahead.
I miss music. I miss driving in the car and listening to music. Singing on the way to the grocery store.
I miss the fucking grocery store.
Yeah.
And traffic. Being stuck in traffic.
Seema, where are you?
I'm already out of the canyon, Dad.
Ridley Scott, welcome to The Screen Show. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you for asking.
The themes in this film, post-apocalyptic themes, are very prevalent at the moment on screen and elsewhere. What was it about this book, this source material, that inspired you, that made you think you could bring something new to these themes?
Well, I was sent the screenplay directly by Mark for me to read for comment. And what I thought was special about it was, apart from the writing is great, adaptation is really good, but actually he avoids the traps of apocalyptic movies. So that's what attracted me to it.
And what do you mean by the traps of apocalyptic movies? Of course, you're no stranger to...
I have no bloody zombies. We've over... What is the matter with us? Why are we so fascinated by zombies? So, and God bless them who make the TV show. So, and World War Z did it so well, I don't want to even go there. So I look at the future in the way that if it were coming to that, it would go tribal immediately. It would probably be fundamentally medieval within about 6 weeks. Those who didn't have weapons would be vulnerable. And for instance, in the United States, I don't want to go political, but tribal would literally become tribal. And they want to take back the land, wouldn't they? Think about the logic of it all. So I start with that. I start off with what would be the realities of it. And so I don't want the film to become like a documentary and depressing. It is entertainment at a certain level.
You say you don't want to go political, but do you think people will read this as a bit of a political allegory in our times, given the kind of border panic that drives a lot of...
Are you kidding? It's happening today as we speak, dude. You know it. I watch the news. People don't know what is going on in the world. They don't watch the news. I'm a news hound, so I watch it three times a day. And where we're going should be really dealt with. And it's not being dealt, is it?
Tell me, I spoke to Connie Nielsen after Gladiator 2, and she talked about how much she loved working with you. And she described you as a kind of, I put it to her that you were, there was always a philosophical underpinning to your films. There was quite a clear one. And she called you a profane philosopher. She said that your films, you speak through beauty and spectacle, and your films are very visceral. And she also said that on set, they're quite visceral to make. She said that you'd light incense on the set of Gladiator 2 and that, you know, a lot of practical effects. Can you tell me about the kind of the way you like to work and the environment you like to create on set?
Well, it comes from my years, almost 20 years as a commercial filmmaker. I didn't have film school. I didn't have drama school. but I had a great profession. I caught the wave. I literally caught the wave of advertising. And from that, I would do many series of commercials, which were perfume, soft drinks, hard drinks, cigarettes, always had great stories. And I ended up, when I was kind of more or less stopped commercial doing film, I was asked to come back and do Steve Jobs' first ad for his first computer. It was called 1984, where they recalled the book, but never talked about the computer, never showed it. So all you got was this 60-second thing which said, we're going to show you at 1984, ain't going to be 1984. That's top advertising. And each 60-second, when you're skilled at that, that art, you can tell a story in 60 seconds. And so that was a very good platform for me to get into movies. So my commercial, I learned about great art directing, great photography, and great cutting. And I think that I carried forward in the film, as did Alan Parker, Adrian Lyne, Tony Scott, and Hugh Hudson. We caught the wave, and I think we changed the way feature films would look. We influenced all the feature films. I'll challenge anybody to that.
It's been great talking to you, and your love of Australian actors is something that really is quite remarkable too, I have to say. You've got two in this one. You clearly love Australian actors.
Well, what is it about you, Aussies? You're so talented.
Ridley Scott, yeah, he does use a lot of Australians. Think about it. Russell Crowe, I was getting the wind up so I couldn't kind of delve further, but Abbey Cornish, Cate Blanchett. Guy Pearce is really good in this, by the way, the Dog Stars. I know everyone will be seeing this for Elordie, but Pearce does convince as this kind of grisly American survivalist dad. Anyway, that ad, by the way, that Ridley Scott was talking about, of course, was for the Macintosh computer. And if you remember, featured a female athlete disrupting this dystopian rally with all these people sitting in front of a giant grey screen by smashing that screen with a hammer. Okay, now to one of the cast members of the Dog Stars, Josh Brolin. Josh Brolin, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thank you very much.
This is a pretty political film, isn't it, to come out at the moment? I mean, you know, it's kind of buried beneath layers of allegory, but would you call it a pretty political film?
I think you can see it that way, but I also think that you can see any film in any way that you want, which is what's interesting about an audience is you get, what did you get from it? You know, Kevin McCarthy's a really good friend of mine and a journalist and a reviewer, and he sent me a voicemail last night that made me look at Dog Stars totally differently than the way that I'd ever seen it, and I was in the frickin' movie. So, and I'm looking at it, and I'm like, wow, I didn't see that, or I didn't notice that. But to answer your question, yeah, the divisiveness, the aloneness that we all feel, especially in my country, you know, and then you go, listen, everybody wants ultimately communal reliability. And do we have it right now? No. So is there a parallel? Sure. It's just a mythological version of it.
Your character is someone who, there's a lot of fear in this film, in the world of this film. And Jacob Elordi's character, Higg, is kind of the one who overcomes that fear a little bit, decides to kind of reach out over the horizon. And your character discourages him from doing that, but in a way that he thinks is right. And partly he's proven right. We won't give anything away. Tell me about your character and what he believes.
No, I think he is right, but I think the motivation is that he doesn't want him to leave because they complete each other. You know, that Higgs comes, or sorry, Bangley comes across as this kind of violent protector and this father figure. But also, if Higg leaves, he's alone. And I think the most terrible thing in Bangley's mind is being alone.
Yeah, there's a That's tenderness in their relationship, isn't there, really?
There's a real tenderness, and it's all covered up by this kind of poke back and forth and this kind of, you know, acerbic dialogue and all this kind of stuff. But I think if you look at Bangley, when Higg really decides to leave, there's a real sadness there. There's a real longing. And I think when the ambush happens, when Bangley is alone, I think that why he's happy is finally there's exchange again.
Yeah.
He doesn't care if it's violent or not. He just cares that there's, it's not just him with his own thoughts.
It's like an MMA fighter or something.
Yeah, exactly.
How do you keep in shape at your age? You're in incredible shape. At our age, should I say? Give me some pointers.
Our age. I don't know, man. You know, I went through something recently where I would, you know, I carried, I don't know if you guys go through pounds. Do you use pounds?
No, kilos. 200, yeah.
Kilos. I 212 pounds for like the last 10 years. And I just carried that heaviness. And then I changed it because I was like, I'm sick of carrying around all this heaviness. So I stopped the carbs.
Okay.
And I got down to my high school weight and I like it.
Wow.
Like it.
As
an older gentleman.
Congratulations, high school weight. Whoa. Where did you shoot? I mean, you shot this, it's in Italy, right?
Yeah.
And partly at Pinewood Studios. I mean, how do you keep a kind of sense of where you're at with your character when you're sort of jumping around the world a little bit?
Not Pinewood Studios, Cinecittà.
There was nothing at Pinewood? I thought there was Pinewood had a post credit. Okay, so Cinecittà.
Maybe. I wasn't there.
Yeah.
I was at Cinecittà in Rome, and then we went into the hills of Italy, which I loved being because I had my family with me. I had my little kids with me. I had my wife with me. And these little tiny villages that me, Guy, Margaret, Jacob, Ridley are hanging out in, having the most incredible food. With the only two restaurants in the whole village, you know, under a chapel that we would go to every day. I mean, it was.
This is the opposite of the film.
If there's the perfect world, it's literally the opposite of the film. If there's a perfect world, it was behind the scenes during Dog Stars.
How did you get back in character after that?
It's funny because it was like an old school communal experience. You know, you don't have that often. And we used to have that a lot. Like even the last time I worked with Ridley, it was a lot like that. We were all in New York. I'd see Denzel. I'd see Russell. You know, we
American
all kind
gangsta.
Of, yeah, we were all kind of on each other. And that was just kind of what you did in movies. You spent time with each other. You wanted to get to know each other. Whether it was competitive or not, it didn't matter. You know, it's like those old school days when you were all in the hallway together auditioning for the same role and you'd be listening to the guy on the other side of the door and you're like, oh shit, he's doing that. I can't do that. I got to do something else that's original. And, you know, I miss those days. It's like a theater mentality and Ridley kind of recreates that beautifully.
Josh Brolin, it's been a pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks, buddy.
Josh Brolin, see him in The Dog Stars. He's good in everything he's in, I think, in cinemas now. You're listening to The Screen Show. I'm Jason DeRosso. We are brought to you by ABC Radio National, the Australian Public Broadcaster's specialist wing. Now, I recorded a panel discussion with three young, very talented filmmakers in Melbourne at the weekend. It was an event organised by the Melbourne International Film Festival. All three of them had films in the festival's Bright Horizons competition, which was won, by the way, by a French-Italian film called La Gradiva. I haven't seen it yet. People say it's great. Well, it won the award. But it has distribution, so I will be seeing it and telling you about it when it gets a release later this year. The filmmakers you're about to hear are Rakan Mayasi, a Palestinian filmmaker whose debut feature is called Yesterday the Eye Didn't Sleep. Unfortunately, it doesn't have distribution yet, but it's a marvelous film set in the Bedouin community in the stunning Bekaa Valley, and it's about two sisters who are caught up in a tribal feud. As sort of bargaining chips, really, it premiered at Cannes in Uncertain Regard. He uses non-professional actors, and he started filming without a script. Marvelous film. Sophie Romvari is a Canadian-Hungarian filmmaker whose film Blue Heron is inspired by her family's experience of suicide. And it uses a time-shifting narrative via which she builds a film within a film that defies easy or simplistic conclusions around grief and mental illness. An absolute standout film, Blue Heron. You can currently see it with a VPN on the Criterion website, along with a number of her short films, which are all worthwhile. Meanwhile, the third filmmaker on this panel is Paloma Schneiderman. She is a filmmaker and musician based in Damaki Makaurau, Auckland, in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Her debut feature is called Big Girls Don't Cry, and it's so sweet. It premiered in competition at Sundance. It is a charming, perceptive film about girlhood, single parenthood, and queer sexuality with an amazing turn from newcomer Annie Palmer in the lead role and Noah Taylor playing her dad. All right, well, let's go now to the panel recorded last Saturday at the Edge Theatre in Federation Square, Melbourne, where I begin by asking Sophie and Paloma the opening question. I do want to begin perhaps by addressing the issue of women filmmakers and who tell stories that appear to be autobiographical or semi-autobiographical. Because I think, if I could put this question to both of you first, do people tend to think if you're a woman filmmaker who has autobiographical elements in their film, that it's all just like a documentary that they've gone out and shot? I mean, how much are you keen to differentiate between the fiction filmmaking and your own lives, especially in forums like this?
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. I read some Letterboxd reviews the other day about our film, which I don't usually do. One of the less favourable ones, which there's not that many, but it was like, it kind of just seems like the director just wanted to tell a story about herself and her life. And I was like, yeah, like that's where the film started from. And I think it is autobiographical, or it starts there, because that's where my instincts feel strongest. The film was always made for my own catharsis, but it shifts along the way, you know. As soon as you start writing and developing the script, and as soon as you start bringing in other people who inherently bring their story to the script as well, it stops being your film in many ways. Yeah, so whilst the essence was autobiographical, I think it's this thing of like writing and creating distance from myself as well, because at some point it just gets too much if it all feels too real.
Sophie, a lot of people have written about your own personal history and the history of your family, because many of your short films, and certainly this film, does engage with that history. Tell me a little bit about that process by which, however, you fictionalise and stylise those real experiences and create something that is essentially a cinematic work out of those experiences that isn't you, that's not necessarily, well, that isn't this documentary.
I think it's a great question and something I've spent a great deal of time thinking about, because there is a flat-out assumption with, I think, especially women filmmakers, that the work is not only personal, but also that there is no distance. And it's almost impossible to make a film that isn't some distance, because it's a construction. Everything in film is a construction. You know, I often bring up Spielberg as a great reference point of someone who makes very personal films, but I'm sure at Q&As, people are not asking him about his mommy issues. You know, and I think he actively decided to wait until later in life to make The Fablemans, which is more expressly personal, but those themes are across all of his work. And, I made many short films that are personal to a degree that is, you know, there's no way to avoid, because I'm in them, they're about my family. And then this film, Blue Heron, has, you know, cast of actors. It's a script that I spent many years working on, but there still continues to be an assumption that everything is verbatim how things happened in my life, which is not a problem. It's more that it creates a bit of a remove from the work that goes into creating these films, you know, like the other people that work on the film, and the work, because it's actually very difficult to make something that feels authentic and that feels personal.
Do you think it's a question that women get asked when they make films more than men? Yeah, I mean, you hinted at that with Spielberg.
Maybe you can answer that.
this film that I've done is coming out of my love for my grandmother. She was married at 14 years old, and I said the best thing to do is to actually find a way to fulfill a kind of promise I had for her. And because she also brought me up, so I was very close with her. And towards the shooting of this film, she had passed away 3 months before the shooting. So this gave me more power to continue and go make the film. But the genesis of the film is an interpretation about her story. And I felt that this is the best thing I could give her as a gift.
Now, your film is set amongst the Bedouin community in the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon. It's about two sisters primarily who end up getting caught in this tribal feud. You know, it struck me that on one level, this is almost, you know, so many films repeat genre tropes. And on one level, the foundation of this film is like a mafia film or something. It's, you know, two different clans and there's a death and there are debts that need to be paid and so forth. And people are talking about extreme violence, they're talking about murder, they're talking about needing to leave the country. And yet, what I really loved about the film is that on screen, there's this languid approach. It's not lacking in tension, but even the way the two sisters move through the film is quite slow, perhaps graceful, very teenager-esque. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that deliberate tension, it strikes me, between the grand drama outside of the frame and this. I mean, I think we see the girls sleep maybe three times in the film, you know. Can you tell me about that decision and the way that tension plays out?
So I purposely wanted to not reveal a lot and try to have the audience also activate their imagination to complete the bigger picture. But generally speaking, in many of the most eventful scenes in the film, turning points and so on, I wanted purposely to not see the violence. I wanted it to be outside the frame. I'm not trying to focus on the physical violence, or it's more psychological. But in terms of the sisters, my whole gaze was to be as close as possible, but to also observe and to be as authentic as possible, because they are real sisters. And so I wanted to not intrude too much in the process. And I wanted to see the intimacy between the two sisters. So not like one scene of sleeping, but a lot of scenes together in the family house or in the other tribe's room as well.
A lot in the bedroom, right? And lying down and Yeah,
and this moment where the camera touches while they are listening to what the men are decision-taking off screen. For example, this is for me one of the most violent scenes in the film, mainly because we don't see it and we see the reaction of the sisters.
Sophie, your film, I think, really deals with a very difficult issue for you personally, tragic events that happened in your real life, in your family. But it's a film that really carefully chooses what to show and what to withhold. There is a tragic death in this film that reflects a tragic death that happens in your personal life. But tell me about that process of working out, which you've done in all your films before this as well, working out what to show and what to not show.
I'm really interested in creating an emotional experience through my films and not so much to tell stories. I want people to feel like they're invited in on the emotional journey of the characters. And so you're being given information kind of at the same time that the characters have access to it. And I think that can be frustrating. But I think frustration is actually a very good and palpable emotion to have when watching a movie, as long as it's engaging. So I think the elements that I withhold or remove are purposeful because they're not things that the character in the film has access to. And the film is very much about access, you know, access to memory, access to answers that you're not going to ultimately receive. So that is mirroring sort of the experience cinematically that you're getting as an audience member. Yeah.
I mean, it begins as a film, I don't know how many people have seen it, but Blue Heron begins as a kind of period piece set in the 90s or early, in the 90s, about a kind of a blended family, but essentially a migrant family coming from Hungary to Canada. And one of the children, the older child, is having difficulties, has mental health issues. And then midway through, you change it tonally. And I would suggest that you start time traveling. We time shift to the future, and then a character we meet in the future who may or may not be your surrogate, I wonder how you'd want to describe this character, then time travels back into the past that was initially, you know, the present of the first half of the film, if that makes sense. but there's a time travel notion, you know, and you're rupturing the narrative flow. Tell me about who that character is and when you had the idea to place that character about midway through the film.
Yeah, the structure of the film is, I think, what made me interested in making this film, because it, like you said, it is sort of a coming of age period film to begin with, and then that gets disrupted. And that's why I was interested in exploring this, because that's my reflection of coming of age. I think my coming of age happened later in life. I feel like in my 20s, I started to understand who I was and you know, what made me into the person I was. And I think oftentimes that depiction happens earlier, and maybe I'm a late bloomer, but...
And this is as in your 20s, you're reflecting on those quite tragic events that you witnessed in your childhood?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that that reflection is ultimately what the film is about, is in retrospect, you're understanding things that you now have more access to. So it made sense to split the film in half, first from the child's perspective and then the adult's. And I think the maybe more conventional way would be to cut back and forth, but I liked the idea of just removing you from that present feeling and having it feel like now you have to piece things together, because that feels like what life is, you know. Ultimately, that's the tragedy of you know, getting information when you're older. You can't apply that to your past, and I wanted to try to depict that cinematically.
Yeah, I mean, there's a moment also where that character who time travels back whispers something into the ear of the girl of the film, who, as an audience, we could think is loosely based on you. Was that a cathartic thing to write?
I don't really believe in the term catharsis. I think it's, if it is to occur, it's very temporary. That's not really why I make work. I think it's more about acceptance than catharsis. I think.
So living with grief more than getting over grief.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Paloma, let's talk about just how wonderfully, acutely perceptive this film is about a girl's experience, not having been a 15-year-old girl, but kind of knowing a 15-year-old girl, you know. And yet this is a film with a strong point of view, but there's never a sense of didacticism in it. There's never a sense that you're trying to teach people a lesson. Can you tell me about how you approached telling this story, and also how you approach this dimension of a kind of sexuality that's starting to become apparent in this girl's life? You know, because it strikes me that you've been very sort of non-judgmental, very reticent to put this story in one box or another.
I mean, I set a like rule for myself with the filmmaking, because I think rules can be quite grounding when you're trying to direct. Even though there is like a retrospect with which this film is told, with the role I set myself is like that we, the audience, are never to know more than Sid knows. Like, we're really the lead character. We have to experience everything that she experiences with her in the same moment, and that's why she's in every scene in the film and we're not showing anything that she isn't privy to. And I think that was like very grounding in terms of making directorial decisions for me, but it also in many ways invited the audience to bring their own retrospect to the film and to the story that was being told. I think, I think it feels authentic because, like Sophie, the story was never the defining or like the priority. It was always feeling governed. It was always about a feeling. And I think that gave us a lot of power to just sit in things and let them evolve quite naturally and fluidly. And
was that reflected in the way you approached the shoot? I mean, did you storyboard at all, or how much was improvised?
Yeah, a lot was improvised, more so in the performance space. Like, the script, we worked for ages. Like, it took years to write the script, but I think what we had with that was like really solid scaffolding and stuck to the beats we knew we needed to achieve and what the scenes needed to feel like. But once we had the script and the understanding of it in the rehearsal room, it was very much just like, you take this now, you say it. We played a lot. Things we found in the rehearsal, we put then into the film. So there was improv and just about every scene. We were just honouring how they were meant to feel. And then,
Your shots change with that improv?
The shots changed all the time. I feel like the first AD probably thought I was a nightmare, and we were. But it's just like the strongest thing you have as a director is an instinct, and sometimes you put up the frame and it's not, it's what you planned, but it's not working with the live environment or something's shifted. I think you always have to be very open to discovery and play. Like, if you come in too planned, it can be quite restrictive of, discovering. And that was very much our style. We would, find the frame in the moment.
Rakan, you're working with non-professional actors, and as you said earlier, real sisters. So you're embedded in this community. The way your film is shot is quite extraordinary, and what I mean by that is it really is out of the ordinary in terms of the sorts of styles that you see in festival films and other films. You use a lot of long takes But you use zooms in such a way that within a long take, we use a zoom to perhaps begin a scene with some background action and characters in the background. Then we might zoom out and focus on another portion of what's in frame in maybe the middle ground. And then we're sort of obviously panning and tilting and adjusting as we go. Tell me about that approach. And was that always your intention to shoot that way? Or was that a response to dealing with the characters and the landscapes where you were shooting?
Both. The answer is both. Let's talk about the zoom. The zooming for me is a tool that is very clearly, it's the gaze. And it's, you know, psychologically, physically, the eyes do not zoom in. This does not exist. So it has this kind of magical approach to looking into, looking further and to observe. A lot of it was chaotic in the shoot, but I knew where the zooming was needed. You know, whether it is zooming in as to get closer or to feel that this element in itself is coming closer to us as an audience. Sometimes it's like it has this optical illusion. Other shots or other scenes were filmed in a static way. So there's this kind of shoulder-mounted approach where we follow the characters, and it's more kind of dramatic in many ways. But a lot of the film had a lot of static shots. And of course, this is because the landscape is in the film is not just a landscape. The mountain is more than an element. It's a character. It's always talked about as if it is the borders to this area, and you cross the mountain and you have to. And also, the space, it's so huge. It's the valley surrounded by these mountains. And it just is a reminder that all the characters and their plots and everything and their intentions, they're belittled by the nature. I was very interested in the coexistence of mythology in this area, in this case, religion and so on. But in order for me to feel that, the only way to see it was to see the majesty of the nature in the space.
I mean, Sophie, I'm wondering, you were nodding from early on when I asked that question, and I mean, you use zooms in your film as well, some of which I couldn't remember, and you reminded me in the green room. Yeah, it's a lot of zooms. Tell me about your approach here stylistically, because obviously there is this rupture in the narrative flow midway through, and there's almost a documentary element for a while before we return to this quite magical sense of filmic reality.
Yeah. No, I agree what you're saying about Zoom. It's like a way to see almost through somebody, and it's not the natural way their eye works, but it's very inherently, it creates like a tension. And the reason when we chose the Zoom lens was there was two or three very important reasons. One was we were inspired by the sort of aesthetic that my dad shot home videos in, which were always similar to the dad in the film, from a distance and sort of capturing these mundane moments, but from far away. So there's sort of an intimacy, but also a separation. And I thought that that was an interesting way to build the language of the film. It's kind of based on the home video aesthetic, but with it being in this like filmic sensibility. We were also really inspired by a sort of 1970s cinematography, like Robert Altman and Cassavetes were kind of our main reference points. But then also on a practical point, we didn't ever move the camera. Everything was always on the tripod. And that significantly helps with budget, to never have to move the camera, to never have to set up a dolly, to, you know, my cinematographer was the camera operator. We had like three people helping with lighting. It was a very, very small crew. So it helped kind of keep things practical. And
the zoom gives you some dynamism within the shot.
Camera's static. It doesn't feel static, even though we're always on sticks. And then the third reason was kind of practical performance-wise. I think to have the camera at a distance creates a bit of a relief for especially the children.
Your parents have obviously seen this film. The character of the father in this film, and I have to stress that these are parents, the parents in this film are going through a really difficult period. They are confused, they're angry, they're frustrated, they're distraught at the way that their son is succumbing to this mental health crisis that's ongoing, and that will end up having tragic consequences for everyone. But the father is depicted, as you mentioned there, making home videos so much. He's always looking at reality and kind of mediating it via this handy cam, or he's taking photos. And an audience could be forgiven for thinking that this is a kind of detached parent we're seeing here. Is that fair on the character? Was that deliberate? Was that how you wanted to depict him?
I was very careful to depict, you know, parents that were, you know, characters and parents that were, you know, complex and make mistakes, but also were trying their best. And that's not just because it's coming from a personal place. That's just a character motivation. You know, I don't want to create caricatures of anyone, especially Jeremy, you know, who is could easily have been just a villain in this film. But I think it was important to me to have some tension between the roles of parents, you know, the mother and the father, and that we often do place the majority of the burden on mothers and families to resolve any emotional issues that are occurring. And I wanted to critique that a little bit and to have that be represented in the film, and also the dad's perspective of seeing things from a distance is something that Sasha as a character inherits. You know, she becomes a filmmaker, but not only does she become a filmmaker, she also inherits the burden. So I think it's sort of like she inherits something from both parents.
But do you think that, so there's a gendered aspect to the way that the parents are dealing with this crisis in your film? Do you think there's a gender critique?
I do think so, yeah. I think that's sort of our societal expectation of parents.
Because there's a line, isn't it? Isn't there, where the mother actually references this disparity, I guess, this unequalness of the, you know, how they share the load, the emotional load of this crisis that their son's going through.
I think everyone is looking for someone to blame, and that parents are not exempt from that. But the film is actively trying to show that although there's frustration, the bigger villain in the story is really society and the expectation of society for people to behave normally. And I think every parent is trying to shield their children and protect their children. But then a lot of what happens is that there's a stigma around things when someone is not behaving in a way that we expect. And, you know, the film is very much about social services and the limitations of that. And so I'm not even trying to blame social services for the limitations, but society's expectation of people to behave in a way, contributing to society, you know, behaving in a way that we deem acceptable. And so I think that's why people want there to be a diagnosis and an answer. But the reality is that that's so rarely going to either resolve things or be the answer.
Paloma, Annie Palmer is fantastic as Sid in your film. She's, as you've mentioned, she's in every scene, a wonderful actor. What had she done before this?
I think she'd been an extra in a Countdown commercial.
Okay. How did you get this performance from her?
I mean, I could see it there from the moment I watched her first tape. And it's always funny because I watched her tape. I was basing off like which tape to watch first. And I picked her one because I thought it was the most wrong, just going off the thumbnail. And it was the first tape I watched, and like 11 seconds in, I was like, oh, this is her.
What was it that...
I think there was something behind the eyes that there was like a duality she held. Like she was both very wise and observant, but she was so naive and innocent at the same time. And I had this inherent need to like want to protect her. I felt really like it was my responsibility to wrap her up and keep her safe, which I thought was very important for a character that does kind of shitty things a lot of the time or makes like quite complicated or flawed decision making. I think I was like, well, if I root for her, then the audience will too. And
did you have to protect her on set though? Did you feel as well? Because this is a grueling shoot, I imagine. For how old was she?
She's 17, yeah, 18 now. She continuously like exceeded expectations. And I think that's the wisdom that she held. And she had like an amazing mum that was there the whole time. And our intimacy coordinator was like, we had our intimacy coordinator before we had our cast. So she was pretty embedded in all the process. But every time I'd ask her, I'd be like, oh, like, are you worried about some of these more explicit scenes? Like, should we talk about them? And she was just like, no, I'm not worried about that part at all. What I'm worried about is the part where I cry or whatever. And it's just like, that was really interesting to me, that intimacy looks different for different people. And that was the more grueling part, was whether she could rip herself open in that way. But she spoke about the camera being there. Like, it's interesting hearing Sophie speak, saying, like, using Zooms to kind of keep the actor safe and have distance, whereas Annie felt very shielded and safe having the camera there. It was like it knew that there was some sort of armoring when it was right there with her, and it was right there with her. So, you know, that was continuously surprising. Like, she was continuously surprising, but I think her willingness to go places from the moment we had her in the audition room was like when I knew she was going to be able to hold this film for 95 minutes. And I shared her audition tape. I shared two tapes with Jane Campion, who's my mentor, and she was very complimentary about both actors, but she was like, there's something about Annie, like, I could watch her fold the washing and still be so compelled, and I felt that to be true as well. And
what was Jane Campion like as a mentor? Can you expand a bit on that? And what is this pop-up film school that she has?
Yeah, it's like kind of, what is this bizarre thing that happened? It was basically Netflix was like, Jane, we want to do your next film after Power of the Dog. And they were like, and then Jane was like, I don't want to do that. I want to start a film school, a pop-up film school. And so Netflix funded this school where we went and moved down to learn from Jane Campion, who I say is equal, like, we share her in Australia and New Zealand. She's like,
she's a New Zealander.
She's a New Zealander, yeah.
But that's true.
And she, in Wellington and Pōneke, she set up the school. She picked 10 people. And people want to know if it's like, it was like her manifesto, we were just practicing, or how present she was, but she was there every day. We learned from it for hours every day in class.
What is she? Yeah, because what sort of things did she impart to you? What pearls of wisdom? How would you describe her approach to filmmaking? And it sounds like you kind of broadly agree with that approach.
We're different filmmakers. Like, I mean, I'm not... Like, I often ask myself, what would Jane do on set? And that was able to get me through a lot of difficult moments. But I think the thing that Jane, you know, Jane is an artist and she's very, very tuned into her instincts. And you can always feel that in her. And she's got this great bullshit radar for you and for herself and for, you know, when she's watching. And I think I've tried to, like, take some of that with me, as, like, if something is, like, pinging in my body as being inauthentic, be it with something I'm watching in a performance or being it when I'm rationalising a decision to myself, you can always kind of feel in your body if you're being honest. And I think that was very, like, encouraged by Jane, as well as this spirit of discovery and play that I mentioned earlier. Like, she is very, like always have a plan and be prepped, but don't be too imprisoned by it, because she thinks that, like, there are signs from the universe all the time that if you're not open and aware to them, you just miss so much. And I think I tried to take that to set from her. It's just like, that's why we moved the camera around a lot. That's why we invited an improvisation or saw things and built that into the story, is just because of that, being aware of your surroundings.
Rakan, can I ask what it was like coming under the mentorship of Keira Starmer and Bellatar? I guess it must be hard to just, you know, sum up concisely, but what were those experiences like?
Yeah, so in 2010, I went to the Asian Film Academy in South Korea. I was selected there. And it's a one-month workshop. And the mentor was Abbas Kiarostami. It was absolutely fantastic, because also I was still making short films and was younger. And it was an eye-opening, because we worked so much with the idea of truth. What is truth? How do you find it? I remember he was showing us his experimental short films. And there was one short film that there was an egg and the waves of the sea trying to push that egg from kind of a rock that it was there in. And all the time you are at the edge of this egg falling into the water, coming back in. And then when the film finished, he asked us whether we think that this was a studio shot or a real shot. I really thought it was a real shot. apparently it was a studio shot. And I didn't believe him. I said, sorry, I don't believe you. This is how much it was believable, you know? So in terms of controlling and like this idea of having controlled or non-controlled environment. Also his working with non-actors, non-professional actors, his advice was very interesting. We had to make a film in South Korea during that time. It was a shit film that we did. And he did not shy away of saying it. So I remember his... with Bellator, it was a bit different because I did the workshop 3 years ago. Also, I think I was very lucky to be selected there. You know, he sadly also passed away maybe less than a year ago. The first thing that he told us in the class, I just entered the class, he said, fuck the script. The moment we entered the class. And then the whole workshop was just about trying to detach from the idea of script writing and trying to write the film with the camera and on the ground and collectively. We also had to make a short film there. I think that one was a bit better than the one in South Korea. I had to make a film with one shot, it's like a long take, 12 minutes with two professional actors. But we all improvised together. The dialogue was completely improvised. This really helped the making of this film. It set the stage for me. I practiced how to improvise with the actors or non-actors and to how to work collectively, how to make use of time because there's just like 2-3 hours of setup tops and then you have to go and shoot it. And there's no money. So all of this low-budget approach to filmmaking, these two workshops really, they changed my life.
Sophie, I mentioned before that there was some great short films. I mean, you can kind of... I mean, all the short films are great on Criterion, so I don't really want to talk about a progression. You can kind of see that the talent, the capacity is there. I'm sure there is for you, but they're all great, you know. Can you talk through some of your early influences and things that have stuck in your mind as guiding stars when you approach filmmaking?
Yeah, I think I'm always the most inspired by films that, speaking of Kiarostami, like comment on the artifice of the film and break open what the filmmaking is doing and invites you into the elements of control, but also the beautiful things that happen when you accept these things from the universe. I think that's the tension that I always try to invite into my filmmaking is what is being provided and what can I, as an artist, control from that and keep it within like the vision that I have. So yeah, Kiarostami was pretty mind-blowing. And then I think that I really like films that acknowledge that what you're watching is a film, but I'm still going to do my best to make you feel like it's not. And that sort of a nod, it feels like an agreement with the audience, which is why I don't really believe in documentary versus fiction. I think it's such the two are intermingled for me. And obviously that's the ethos that Kiarostami had as well. I recently looked back at my short films. I had never seen them all together, and I was quite struck by how many things I try in those films that actually show up in Blue Heron and how I've already been repeating myself so much. Like the one-sided phone call that occurs in Nine Behind is in Blue Heron, and girls on laptops watching archive footage. It's just like I didn't realize I was doing that, actually. Repeating and the obsession with these kinds of thematics. Yeah.
Well, some of the great filmmakers just keep repeating the same film over and over again, so there's no shame in that at all. We're going to go to some questions that have been coming on my tablet here from the audience. First question, how do you feel about making art in the current climate of angst and constraint in the world?
Has there ever not been? Paloma?
That's an answer. Yeah, has there ever not been?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I have heard this like comment about a lot of films coming out being kind of joyless at the moment, or there's like a cynicism to a lot of the films out there that are being programmed and stuff. But I don't know. I also have toyed with the idea of like making a film where only good things happen and it's a happy ending. And I'd like to do that exercise of making that film, but I just don't. I don't think anyone would like it, you know? But yeah, I mean, like Sophie said, isn't it a tale as old as time? It always feels pretty difficult out there, and we're always responding through our work. And
I think I think that filmmaking is just such a, no matter if you are coming from means or not, it's just an insane privilege to get together with a group of people who are just there to support your vision and your desire to say something. It's like, so no matter the circumstances, to be able to have things come together and allow you to do that, it's an intense privilege. You know, we talk a lot about the exhaustion of filmmaking and the instability and all these things, but it's such an insane thing to do with your life that you have to love it, you know, regardless of the circumstances that it puts you in. It's a joy and a privilege. Yeah.
Rakan, how about you? I mean, when I talk about when I say these words, climate of angst and constraint, as a Palestinian filmmaker, I think you'd have particular feelings about that.
Of course. First, I think that cinema has this instrumental, it's an instrumental medium to really register time and space and all this memory that is very important to document the world as it is now. As a Palestinian, I mean, we were filming at the border between Lebanon and Syria a bit more than a year ago, and Israeli fighter jets were bombing in the background, not close to us, but I remember twice I had to repeat the take because there the sound of an explosion was embedded over the dialogue. You know, once it was without dialogue, so we continued because I could remove the sound in post, but sometimes this is how difficult it is. Also, the idea of finding another way to make a film, this alternative way of filmmaking with low budget, guerrilla filmmaking, small team. Sometimes this is a reaction towards this capitalist world, you know, to try to find your own way of making a film. Not that having a budget is a bad thing, but sometimes you don't have that. And sometimes, for example, without writing a script, it's very difficult to get money. I was lucky because having moved to Belgium, there's this fund that could be given without a need for a script, just a treatment or an outline. And I took that fund gladly, happily, luckily, and then we made the film. And then the rest of the funding, for example, was raised in post-production when you begin to prove what you've filmed. So there's this other way of trying to make a film.
Here's another question. Each of your films were born of something very personal. Do you see having a personal connection to the story you're telling imperative to making a film? Would you ever be compelled to make a film far from your experience?
I think that film, if I made a film far from my experience, it would also suck, so I probably won't do that. I think more than anything, it's just as a director, you're asked to operate out of such a place of instinct, and if I haven't lived some version of it, then I don't have those instincts and I can't lead and land this thing we're all trying to do. So whilst I think like distance is excellent and imagination is great, and there are just mechanics like to making a stronger script, and that often involves writing things that you haven't lived but you can access a feeling of it, or you know someone that has. But yeah, I certainly think that I will always need personal access to the stories I tell.
I think that something being personal, something can be personal in many different ways. It doesn't have to be direct experience. You know, like you spoke of, your film sounds very personal to me, even though it's about your grandmother or inspired by. And I think, I've been very motivated to work through something very particular in my work up until this point. And that's been sort of my life's project up until this point. But I think where I draw the line is I need to have a perspective on whatever it is. I need to be able to feel like there's a reason that I'm making this film and not someone else, and that I can bring something to it that I think is worth spending years of my life, you know, because I don't have any interest, like we talked about, to just tell stories. Like I need to find a reason why should this be a film, and why should I be the one making it? Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not against the idea of going and making a film without a very strong personal connection. But for now, it's mostly about the feeling, what you feel. Are you connected to this idea or not? It might be a picture, it might be an emotion, it might be just something that sparks and we go and make a film. For now, I'm drawing from my own personal experiences, from my identity. But I'm not going to say no, because maybe in 20 years, if we're still alive and making films, then yeah, I'm open to that, you know.
Is there a film you've caught at the festival which featured a striking image or an idea that might inspire something in your next feature? I don't know if you've been watching many films, but have you seen anything? Is there an image that...
Yeah, I saw Fatherland because I missed it while it was in Cannes as well, but I missed it. It's a very beautiful film. It's a great film because the minimalism, the simplicity that is put into this film, the most important events, you never see them in the film. And when you are expecting to see these incidents or important events and you don't, suddenly you begin to feel that, wait, a film can be a very strong film without revealing anything. Even the emotions that were revealed after a murder takes place in the film were a bit slowly given bit by bit. So this was a striking film for me.
Sophie or Paloma, have you seen anything that stuck in your mind? It's okay if you haven't, but...
We've mostly just been hanging out.
Well, this is so lame, but I was watching Sophie's film and thinking... because I've often, like, you know, lean on character. Characters and performance is everything. And I think it was a revelation to me to watch Sophie's film, in that there's a moment where, I won't give away too much, but you're on a bowl of potatoes, essentially. Have I said too much? Have I ruined the film? And you kind of, the characters aren't even really in frame. They're kind of blurs, and you can feel everything. And it's just, I mean, you probably know the show I'm talking about. And I thought that was quite a revelation, and that, like, and I think it's the same what Rakan's talking about what we show and what we tell and what we don't. And I think, yeah, just having confidence in the work that people will feel what you need them to feel without you having to be like, and this is the character feeling this, you know. I think that was inspiring.
It's a particular question, another question here for you, Paloma, and it's that you said that your film was what you wish you'd seen at 14, but it's realistically explicit content would prevent many young people from being able to see it. How do you balance authenticity and accessibility amidst strict ratings boards?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question, because it is film for 14-year-old me, but definitely not appropriate for a 14-year-old to see. But I think there's work being done, even just getting the conversation out in the ether, like, you know, like distilling some of that shame around female sexuality, female identity. I think that does trickle down into, like, younger spaces, even if it's, like, not directly what that person can see. But I think a big turning point for me in deciding what to show in the film and how bold to be was, like, a mentor said, like, when we had done a couple drafts of the script, she was like, maybe could feel my nervousness or my protectiveness over the characters. And she was like, I need you to now go and write your most, like, brave, boldest version of this script, if anything, just for me. And it was interesting doing that, because I think the script ended up somewhere in the middle between those two really intense versions and what was already there. And I think it was just an exercise of just being brave. Like, I can only operate from my own retrospective memory and access point, but, like, I just wish someone was talking about female masturbation when I was that age. I just wish, like, people were talking about first sexual desires, and I could only just revisit that when I was making decisions. It's just, like, the openness and dialogue that I felt I needed, and just to be brave with it, because it is fucking uncomfortable. I can't swear, can I?
No, you okay. Just did. That's fine. Final question from me. Where do you place yourselves sort of within the economic structures of this world? You've all made fairly...
The bottom.
Yeah. And where do you, what do you see ahead of you on your road to making more films? Do you see yourselves making films at this level? Will you be able to make films at this level if that's where you see yourselves for, you know, the future, into the future? Or do you see yourselves trying to springboard into upper echelons of filmmaking, budget-wise?
you know, low budget is also a film language. It's not only about how much money we could raise to make the film, because these restraints and limitations really help in decision making at the spot. A lot of what doesn't happen on screen is related to also not having money to show it. So it kind of becomes this film language. I find it very romantic to make a low budget film. Of course, the food you eat while shooting is really very bad for you, but then, you know, it works at the end of the day. I'm working on my next feature film. It will cost 3 times as much as this one will, but it's also because there's a lot of traveling. There's filming in 3 countries. So probably in each country, it will still be low budget. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with what you said about low budget. The restrictions, like creating reasons for aesthetic choices, that can be actually very helpful. But I made this film in Canada, and it's a very low budget film. It was around $500,000 Canadian, which is similar to Australian dollars, I think. And it was just enough money to make this version of this film. But I wrote for the budget, and I made, you know, all those decisions were made with that budget in mind. So I never felt like I was, you know, lacking anything except for maybe better food on set. But I will say that I loved making this film. Every part of it, it was a pure joy. And I think that's because I had so much control around how I made the film, who I made it with, who I got to cast. And so that's my main motivation moving forward, is I want to continue to have that. So if that means I have to work with lower budgets, so I don't have, you know, people telling me what to do, then so be it.
Does that mean a day job you need?
I work at a movie theater at the moment. Mm. So yeah, I guess it does.
Maybe this is naive and silly to think, but I wonder if you always kind of acclimate to whatever the budget you have is, like, so it always kind of feels like just enough. Because we had a reasonable budget on this, like, because the Film Commission in New Zealand is very supportive of their filmmakers, and some people would probably say it was heaps, and I'm sure my producers in the room say it was not enough, but you just make do. I obviously chase expansion, and I want to grow my craft, and you want people to see your work, and I don't know if that necessarily means bigger budget equates to that, but I just feel like I'm in service of storytelling, whatever budget that looks like. But to answer your question, yes, I am going to make the next Spider-Man.
All right, on that optimistic note, and why not, thank you to you, all of you, for this fascinating discussion. It's been great to hear from you.
Thank you.
That was a panel recorded at the Melbourne International Film Festival last Saturday at the Edge Theatre in Federation Square. You heard from filmmaker Sophie Romvari, who's the director of Blue Heron, Rakan Mayasi, the director of Yesterday, The Eye Didn't Sleep, and Paloma Schneiderman, director of Big Girls Don't Cry. All three films eventually will end up on streaming platforms. I recommend you seek them out. But if you're interested in seeing them in cinemas, you can catch Sophie Romvari's film at the Adelaide Film Festival. That's Blue Heron at the Adelaide Film Festival. And Paloma Schneiderman's Big Girls Don't Cry has a slot later in the year at Sydney's Queer Screen Festival. That's it for another episode of The Screen Show. I'm Jason DeRosso. Thanks as always to producer Sarah Corbett. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.